Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, Jackie Robinson did more than just break baseball's color barrier in 1947. What's his legacy today? Also, what's driving up gas prices? But up front, women are leaving their jobs at four times the rate of men during the COVID pandemic. It's one example of how women are feeling the brunt of the economic impact of the pandemic. It's also a topic that will be addressed in the local Mentoring Monday networking event for women coming up this Monday in Harrisburg, or Camp Hill, I should say. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Our guest today, Sarah Ganim, who won the Pulitzer Prize for her investigation and coverage of the Jerry Sandusky child abuse scandal while reporting for the Patriot News. She's also a former correspondent at CNN. And Kate Barron is the president of the Pennsylvania Media Group, who own and publish the Patriot News and Digital Penn Live. Kate Barron, let me start to you with you. We'll talk about the mentoring event coming up on Monday. What is Mentoring Monday?
First of all, thanks so much, Scott. It's always a pleasure to be on Smart Talk. Mentoring Monday, and we're doing a virtual version of it, of course, this year, is an evening of career coaching and networking for all working women. You can be a job seeker. You can be a student still trying to decide on their career path. And we'll get to this, but I think it's a really even more valuable experience this year because of the disproportionate impact the pandemic is having on working women, which you just mentioned. During the event, it's from 6 to 8 p.m. this Monday, again, online. Women get the chance to meet one-on-one and in groups with more than 30 local volunteer mentors. These are business leaders, they're executives, they're entrepreneurs. We have people coming from healthcare, education, banking, state government, social services, contracting, insurance, the nonprofits, you name it. And the online platform that we're using for this event is, I call it Zoom on steroids. It has separate meeting rooms. You can have one-on-ones. It'll have group tables. There's even a virtual lounge to hang out in. We took it for a test drive last night, and it's really pretty amazing. And like so many of us, I've been glued to Teams and Zoom calls for the past year. To register, real quickly, just Google Mentor Monday PA, and you'll get to the ticket site. Again, the event runs 6 to 8 p.m. this Monday. Tickets are $15, but we want to make sure that anyone who wants to attend can do so. There are some sponsored tickets still available, thanks to one of our major sponsors, Renewal by Anderson. And interested persons can contact me or the event organizer, Mary Clayton, at Penn Live, if they would like to take advantage of those tickets. But we're very proud to have Sarah Ganim as this year's keynote speaker on. And of course, Scott, all of us know her as the investigative journalist. But I have to say, we invited her because she's also a working mom. So thank you so much.
Well, we'll talk to Sarah about her experiences during the pandemic in just a moment. But Kate, something you touched on, and we're going to talk with Sarah about this as well, but that you said that it's probably even more significant for women to be talking with mentors during this pandemic at this time. Talk about that a little bit more. Why is it more important?
Well, I'll quote from a headline I read a couple weeks ago. The country is in the middle of what they're calling a she session. That's in lost jobs, layoffs or otherwise, for women all across the U.S. And there's a big reason for this. Women were more likely to work in the industries that were hardest hit by the pandemic. I mean, think about restaurants, hotels, small businesses, healthcare. They were less likely to be in jobs that allowed them to telecommute, like I know we've all been so fortunate to be able to do. They are also far more likely to be the primary caregiver for kids and aging relatives. And as we all know, in-classroom school has been an on-again, off-again proposition this year. For many, many people, childcare is just proven to be too expensive, and it's also just not available for everybody. Just one stat, Scott, national figures, I pulled this from Time Magazine. Since last March, since this all started, 28% of all employed women with kids under 18 at home have either temporarily or permanently left the workforce to become those primary caregivers to children. And that compares to 10% of working men. And there's another real justification for this. Oftentimes men were in the higher paid position. It made practical sense. I'd also note that Black mothers, Hispanic mothers, and single mothers were definitely among the hardest hit. Some estimate it set women back a generation in lost wages and opportunities. So we're really hoping Mentoring Monday is just one little thing that we can offer, words of support, words of advice, and hopefully some valuable connections for women that want to get back in the workplace or just want to better their job situation.
Well, that 28%, almost a third of women, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Sarah Ganim, why are women leaving the workforce at such a higher rate than men?
Well, I think Kate just laid out the alarming statistics, and I'll just add one more headline that I think really caught my attention during this time. It was the Washington Post writing a story with a headline saying coronavirus childcare crisis will set women back a generation. And you think about that a generation, I mean, that's a really tough headline to read, especially because it really feels like there are no real solutions being offered. And going back to Mentoring Monday, that's why I was really excited to give this keynote in this moment, because I do think that it's women who have the ability to help other women get through this more than anyone else. And I think when I look back on my career so far, it's my female bosses who have worked hard to really help me grow and prop me up in times where I, where my at-home duties were a little bit too much to handle at the moment. And it really, you think about it, women are the only ones that are in the position to help other women. Men often don't experience the same burden that we do when it comes to work family balance. And so, having the ability to having the drive really to reach out and help another woman when you see her faltering or struggling with what's going on. I mean, I think that's what Mentoring Monday has always been about, but I think that even more so right now, it's a time when we really need to recognize and reflect on how we can help each other.
Scott, this is our second year to do this program. And I'll tell you, last year, I expected to get a lot of questions about how do I get a job? How do I move up the ladder? The expected kind of hard job questions. I swear half the questions we got from the folks that attended were about those very issues, work-life issues. And this was before the pandemic hit. So I can't even imagine what it's going to be like now, but we're hoping that those conversations are going to be helpful.
Yeah, before all of this, Kate, I would just add that I think a lot of women may have felt like men in leadership positions don't understand the extra burden on women, but then also that a lot of women in leadership positions failed to address those burdens because they felt somehow like all women should have to pay the same price that they've paid and kind of struggle in that same way. But really, it's the women who could see the progress being made and help each other that have really stood out for me in my life, personally helped me. And I think that that's where progress is made. And having more leaders with that mindset of collectively we can make progress that will help all of us. I think that's what this is all about. And I think that can be really powerful.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And I would say that's one reason why I found it really heartening. We actually have a waiting list to be mentors. Women from all over the mid-state raised their hands that they want to help, and they want to help other women.
Sarah, childcare has been pointed to as one of the main reasons that so many women have left the workforce. During this pandemic, is it that there's not enough childcare, or is it because there are children at home trying to learn virtually? They're because their schools aren't open. I mean, just what is the issue when it comes to childcare?
Well, I think it's a combination of those and more factors, right? I mean, we all are under one roof. Before the pandemic, there was actually a movement to move into cities. People were re-embracing city life, and that means moving into smaller places, moving into apartments. And there were a lot of benefits to that pre-pandemic. One of them was a shorter commute, right? So you could actually spend more time with your kids and with your family. And now what that translates to is less space. And if you've got kids in virtual school, and you're expected to be, you know, attending or paying attention to work at the same level that you were pre-pandemic, I mean, there's just not enough hours in the day. There's not enough attention available, right? It's just, it doesn't work. I happen to be lucky enough that I have my number one mentor in life, my mother, who lives with me and can be there to help with my child care situation. She's there with my two-year-old all day long. Without that, this would have been a completely lost year for me at work. I would have not been able to do it, period. Like I would just not be working. So, not everyone is as fortunate as me to have a parent or someone in their home with them. But it's logistically impossible to do two things at once. And that's a situation that a lot of women are in.
Women had more responsibilities for childcare and housework than men before the pandemic, even though, I don't know whether there's actually been surveys or research to document this, that men are doing much more than what they used to. But still, the reality is that women do have most of the housework, have most of the childcare responsibilities. What about now? I mean, during the pandemic, is it even more disproportionate? Sarah?
Well, I think I can only speak for myself here. I mean, my husband has certainly stepped up and, he always took the chores that I didn't like. So I have to give him credit for that. He's the dirty dishes and the laundry and the trash. But, you know, he certainly has stepped in at times where I don't even have to ask. You know, I'm on a Zoom call and the baby is wreaking havoc and he'll, you know, close his laptop and take her somewhere. And I greatly appreciate that. But, you know, I also recognize that, you know, there are situations where that's impossible. You know, we have both been on Zoom calls before. Whose meeting is more important? How do you quantify that? You know, like that's a real struggle. And I'm sure a real strain for a lot of people. You know, on top of the fact that you're all cooped up in one place together now for almost 11 months. My daughter figured out how to open the front door of our apartment the other day, ran into the hallway and just stood there. And I went out and I said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "Mommy, I just want to stand in the hallway." I mean, you know, they want to get out. We all do.
That's right.
I've had that feeling too. You can tell your daughter. here's an email from Bridget and along the same line. She says, "As a full-time working mom of two children under three, I have to say the single most important factor in whether I can meet the high demands of my job and balance my children's care is whether my husband's male boss gives him the flexibility needed to help me. Men must step up and make room for their male employees to do so for their families. Is that an issue, Bridget? Or excuse me, Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And that's sort of my point about women stepping and helping other women, recognizing when you're in a situation, even if you don't say something about it, you know, recognizing Bridget makes a good point that, you know, it's often the boss of your husband who maybe needs to recognize or step in. And all of us kind of seeing that we're in the same boat here, this isn't this is affecting all of us and stepping in even when the question isn't asked, when people are not asking for help. And I think women are in a particularly good position to do that for each other. And it's been really heartening to see that. I know I've had to write some last minute emails, you know, "Sorry, I just don't have childcare right now. I can't do this meeting. I can't do this meeting and pay attention. I can't be effective during this meeting, so I'm sorry, I have to reschedule." And I've never had any pushback for that, thankfully. I think everybody kind of understands, but I think asking for help and giving help when you see it is really key.
We have a question here from Jordan, who is a student at Millersville University. Do you think mental health is talked about enough with children? Or do you think discussions and even teaching mental health should become more normalized at an early age in schools? I know my own experience, the only time we're taught about mental health is if you took a psychology class in high school. I think that, mental health is something that is getting more attention. But when we bring it into this dynamic, the family dynamic of women leaving the workforce, being home with kids, the dad's role, kids just like your daughter, Sarah, that just wanted to stand out in the hallway to do something different. I mean, this brings up another issue, the mental health that, what we're all going through, the stress that we're all going through right now. And I just wonder, going forward, how are we going to get back to normal, even if we do get back to normal post-pandemic?
Kate, you want to take a stab at this one?
Yeah, that's such a tough question, Scott. I will say, and I'm going to reduce this to something very simple. A lot of it has to do with support from others, knowing you're not alone, and talking with others, having those conversations. And I think so many of us have retreated inwardly in the past year just because of the conditions of the pandemic. Again, this is what we found last year with Mentoring Monday. Women just wanted to talk. The session was over in 2 hours. People lingered for another hour to meet new faces and be able to talk about similar shared experiences and pressures between the whole work life, family life situation. And again, no answer to your original question, Scott, but I will say that, again, it's all about, I think that a lot of people will get a lot of comfort and a lot of support out of being able to talk to others in the same position.
I also think adults recognizing the problem, like you're recognizing it, Scott. I teach college level classes, and last semester, I just had a feeling, and no student said anything to me initially. I just had a feeling that they were struggling. And, this is via Zoom. And I said, how's everybody doing? And I have to say, the rest of the class was a therapy session because, they were college kids and they were actually back on campus, but they were expected to just be figuring it out in a time where, they're basically pioneering, right? No one's ever done this before. And I think recognizing that students are struggling with things that maybe we as adults don't see as significant, something as small as missing graduation, that's not small, but something that adults may say that's not that big of a deal because my problems are X, Y, Z. It is a big deal to kids. It is a big deal to these students. And it will be life-changing. And this is actually something tangential that I explored recently in a podcast episode that I did about how schools are sort of not tracking or not consistently nationwide tracking attendance of students. And so without that information, we won't know where the gaps are in 1 year, 2 years, 3 years down the line. And I think collectively as a society, as a nation, we could be doing a better job to make sure that things like this don't become lasting problems, or at least to mitigate some of the lasting problems that are inevitable by doing a better job of paying attention to where they're struggling now.
One final question. We had a listener ask this question. How do women get back to their pre-pandemic levels of employment once they do go back to work, if they do go back to work? Because as both of you said, there may be women who permanently have left their jobs. But how do they get back? And I think this is probably an economic question as well. But how do they get back to where they were before leaving work during the pandemic?
My gut reaction to that question is it's up to companies and to female leaders who are in the position where they're keeping their jobs to make sure that they're reaching out and helping these women who have lost their jobs. And I think companies do bear the responsibility of figuring out a fix to this because women are a great asset to any organization. Women of color are a great asset to any organization. They're disproportionately affected by this. We should be making a real concerted effort to make sure they come back And I don't know exactly how that looks. I don't have all the answers, but I think that the responsibility falls on leadership of companies. You know, that is, it is not just a loss to the employee, it's a loss to the company that lost them. So it's on that company to figure out a way to fix it. That's my sort of gut reaction to that question.
You know, yeah, I agree 100%. It is up to the companies. We don't want to lose this talent. We can't lose this talent, or we are going to be in a serious, serious crisis. We have to be flexible. We have to be understanding. We have to do our best to support women in the workplace. And again, make sure that they don't leave in the first place. And then if they do leave, get them back in.
Kate Barron, one last time, for those who would like to participate in Mentoring Monday, how can they do it?
Yes, please, to register, just Google Mentor Monday PA. You'll get to the ticket site. Very easy registration process. Again, this event runs from 6 to 8 p.m. live online this coming Monday. Tickets are $15, but as I said, we are happy to provide sponsored tickets to those people that need them. I'll give you my email, cbarron@penlive.com. Happy to help you with this. We'd love to see as many people attend this as possible. And again, Scott, thanks so much for having us on.
Well, thank both of you for being with us today. Sarah Ganim, who Pulitzer Prize winner with the Patriot News, former correspondent at CNN, Kate Barron, president of Pennsylvania Media Group. Thank both of you for being with us today. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Jackie Robinson is remembered as the African-American man who broke baseball's color barrier in 1947 when he joined the Brooklyn Dodgers. Robinson not only became a sports hero, but he used his status as a pioneer to blaze a trail for other blacks in all walks of life and to become a civil rights icon. So what is his legacy more than 70 years later? We're joined now by Michael G. Long, who is editor of the new book, 42 Today, Jackie Robinson and His Legacy. Michael Long has written several books on Robinson, civil rights, and nonviolent protest. Michael Long, always good to talk with you. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we're at smarttalkwitf. Mike, lots of books about Jackie Robinson, the athlete, but not as many about Jackie Robinson, the man, and what his life was like after baseball, except for the few that you have been involved with. Why is there so much attention on Jackie Robinson, the athlete, and not after his time with the Brooklyn Dodgers?
Well, you know, he was heroic on the baseball diamond. And 1947 was a really dramatic year. This is the year that he shatters the color barrier in Major League Baseball. On April 15th, 1947, he makes his debut. And in this year, he's instructed by Branch Rickey to turn the other cheek. So in 1947, he's not giving back what he gets. He turns the other cheek. He soldiers on nonviolently. I think he's safe and non-threatening to white America in 1947. And we've really frozen him there, Scott. Major League Baseball has definitely frozen him there. Most of us have frozen him there as well. But Rachel Robinson wants us to know that her husband was far more than a Hall of Fame baseball player. She calls him an informal civil rights leader, and that he was from 1956 to 1972. He struggled for civil rights and first-class citizenship for all Black Americans. We forget that, Jackie Robinson, because he's more threatening in those years. He threatens white American politics, business, and the lack of attention to civil rights.
Well, let me read an excerpt from the book. By the way, the book is a series of essays by some of the most talented writers in America. But this is from Howard Bryant, who's written for ESPN, the magazine, and other publications. The periods of the Jackie Robinson story that have received the least attention have been overlooked, not due to them being the least important, because they are the most difficult to square with the fantasy of the hero narrative, both his and that of his time. When he was a symbol of advancement, safe, unthreatening, he was a hero. When he demanded ownership, unconditional, without permission, he was angry, bitter, and agitating. I think that paragraph sums it up pretty well. You can't sum up Jackie Robinson's life pretty well, but how many Americans viewed Jackie Robinson. When he broke the color barrier, he was a hero. But after his career in baseball ended and he started speaking out about issues and civil rights, many people looked at him as, oh, he's another agitator. Talk about that, Mike, if you would.
Yeah, he was definitely considered an agitator. You know, even after 1948, when he stops turning the other cheek on the baseball diamond, Robinson really straightened his backbone. He argued with umpires. He took sports writers to task when he thought that they depicted him unfairly. He certainly argued with other players as well. He felt this incredible release after he was released from that biblical admonition to turn the other cheek. There's this great scene in 42 of the movie, which I love, by the way, when Robinson goes into the tunnel between the dugout and the locker room and he busts his bat and breaks it in two. That's the type of Robinson we depict in the book. This man who had this fiery character, but also kept it in check in 1947, but later let it out. And boy, when he let it out, people ran for cover. Robinson did not hold back on his convictions. In fact, this is one of the reasons why he loved Muhammad Ali, too. Those two were peas in a pod in the sense that they really spoke out. And Robinson attracted as much negative attention as Ali did during the Vietnam War.
But for different reasons. I know we're jumping around a little bit here, but for different reasons, as the book shows, that Muhammad Ali famously said that he wasn't going to be drafted, wouldn't go to Vietnam, and Jackie Robinson supported the Vietnam War. So talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, Robinson was anti-communist, no doubt about it. He also had a son, he and Rachel had a son, Jackie Jr., who served in the Vietnam War in the Army. And he was wounded in battle. He earned a Purple Heart there. And Robinson just thought the world of his son. So he had a deep allegiance there. But he was pro-war. He was pro-Vietnam War. He supported Johnson. So when Ali came out and announced that he was refusing to serve in the Army in a really colorful way, I encourage everybody to check that out. Robinson was lit. He believed that Muhammad Ali owed service to his country, this country that had made him wealthy. And he criticized Muhammad Ali up and down. At the same time, however, he praised Ali for sticking by his convictions. That's probably one of the most marked characteristics of Robinson, the decision to stand by his beliefs. And he admired that in Muhammad Ali, even as he criticized him for those beliefs.
You know, many people may be hearing this, Mike, for the first time today, because they have this image of Jackie Robinson, but hearing that he had such a bad temper, but that he promised to turn the other cheek after like 3 years in the major leagues, he finally was allowed to show his true personality. But Branch Rickey, who was the general manager of the Dodgers at the time, chose Jackie Robinson rather than Roy Campanella, who was a Hall of Fame catcher and African-American as well. Roy Campanella had a personality that he was more laid back, a little more quiet than Jackie Robinson. Why did Branch Rickey choose the player who had the man who had a bad temper to be the first, rather than one whose personality wasn't so volatile?
One of his fellow players in the Negro Leagues said that Jackie Robinson had a temper like a rattlesnake, and he did, no doubt about it. And I think that Rickey was attracted to that. He wanted somebody who would be fiery and explosive on the mound. He wanted somebody who would demonstrate excellence in his athleticism. And Robinson wasn't the best player in the Negro Leagues by any stretch of the imagination. But in Robinson, he saw a complete package. He saw somebody who was excellent on the diamond, but also had the type of character that he was looking for. And that is a solid moral character, but also a solid character in the sense that he was explosive, but also willing to swallow all these racist taunts and jeers in order to make the game black. And he really did. You know, Robinson injected Negro Leagues into the game. So when we see somebody doing a wide turn at first base or dancing between the bases or doing a hard slide or stealing home plate, that's Jackie Robinson ball, one of the contributors says in the book. So Robinson really transformed not only the color of players, but he also transformed the game itself. Ricky was looking for that type of person who could bring all of these different dimensions to the game. And Ricky was a really shrewd businessman. He knew that by bringing Robinson in with a really stable life, he could make the turnstiles click. And Ricky made a lot of money off of Jackie Robinson.
Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier in baseball. I get the sense that many white Americans today still see it as a sports story. But in 1947, and maybe even up until today, but especially in 1947, this was more than just a sports story. This was a historic moment in American history, especially for African Americans. In what way? How did they look at it differently?
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out. Black Americans wrote numerous letters to Jackie Robinson in 1947. They would talk about gathering around the radio and the town store and listening to the games and cheering for him. They would write letters, little kids would write letters about how he inspired them and how they hoped for a better America because of his playing. I mean, he felt enormous pressure from Black Americans. He didn't want to fail in the great experiment. So Black America was deeply touched by Robinson, not only because of his athletic prowess, which was exceptional, but also because of the dignity that he carried when he was on the field. White America had a different reaction. In 1945, the New York sports writers got together in New York and Manhattan. They put on a skit. And in this skit, Jackie Robinson appears as a black butler. It's very embarrassing. It's a horrific skit. And black newspapers took these sports writers to task. The white sports writers never really said Robinson's debut in the Dodgers in proper context. They didn't describe how that debut bubbled out of this wretched history of racism in the United States, and how it was part of America's original sin, and how his debut in the Dodgers would end up transforming America. They missed that because they were part of the racist system that created the barrier that Robinson had to overcome.
Did they know that at the time? I mean, just earlier this week, we were talking about history. Did they know that they were part of the racist system, those white sports writers? Or was this just, this was America in 1945, 1947?
No, I think they knew that, especially in New York. Black newspapers and black media folks had been clamoring a long time for a black player. Believe it or not, communist newspapers, the Daily Worker, was also clamoring for a black player. And they pressured New York politicians to squeeze the Major League Baseball owners to admit a black player. And so it was in the air, Scott. They knew what was going on. And I don't want to absolve them. But I also will say that they were part of their time. They were coming out of a white culture of white racism. And so while they were part of their time, there was also talk in the air about breaking the color barrier, and they were not supportive.
And I want to go to something that you wrote about in the book, and that is number 42. Today is iconic. Major League Baseball has retired the number 42 for all time for all teams in baseball. No one will ever wear number 42 again. But when Jackie Robinson was assigned number 42 for the Dodgers, it was a high number. Players were usually assigned lower numbers. The players that got the higher numbers, there was some question about whether they were going to stick around. And this goes back to what you were saying, a word you used before, experiment. This was an experiment. What if it didn't work? What if Jackie Robinson had failed? Would we be even, I mean, how far would that have set back race relations at that point?
That's a great question. Michael Sam failed in the NFL, and that's been a sad story, and we haven't seen huge advances in the NFL in terms of gay issues. Michael Sam was gay, and he, in that experiment, failed completely, unfortunately. When Robinson showed up in the Dodgers locker room, he not only did not have a locker, his jersey was on a peg. And you're right, he had a high number, 42, right? Number four was available, number two was available. The Dodgers didn't give this to Robinson. Duke Snider, another rookie, got a low number. They gave Robinson number 42 on a peg because they weren't quite sure that experiment would work. Robinson made that experiment work. He didn't depend upon white players. He didn't depend upon Pee Wee Reese, for example. He didn't depend upon Dixie Walker. He didn't depend upon any white stars. He made a way out of no way. And I think Robin and Dr. King was right when he said that Jackie Robinson was a sit-iner before the sit-ins, freedom rider before the freedom rides. He made that experiment work, and he made a number out of 42. You're right, we didn't know 42 before Jackie Robinson. We sure as heck know it now. Had the experiment failed, those would have been rough days for Black America, I think. I'm so glad it succeeded. I think Robinson was the right man at the right time and in the right place. And wow, he not only exceeded, he not only did well with that experiment, he flourished. This is a guy who put up Hall of Fame statistics under enormous pressure. He thought that there were people in the stands who might shoot him. He performed under enormous pressure from racists and still put up Hall of Fame stats.
You know, I'm wondering about the timeliness of the book, Mike. 42 today, Jackie Robinson in his legacy. Over the past year, the nation has had what has been described as a racial reckoning. Is that what made Jackie Robinson's or makes Jackie Robinson's legacy even more relevant today?
I do think it's especially compelling today. I think we understated the racism that Robinson existed in existed in 1947. I think we continue to understate that racism in 2021. Robinson's story is a story that has relevance today, especially in terms of police brutality. Robinson himself was a victim of police brutality when he was a kid. He was also somebody who, believe it or not, who near the end of his life stood next to the Black Panthers and announced his support for Black Americans who took up arms in their own defense. These were Black Americans who experienced a lot of police brutality, especially the Black Panthers, and Robinson defended them. We continue to see police brutality against Black Americans throughout America, and I think Robinson would be deeply disappointed about that and his own failures, and America's failures, I should say, to transform that, to change that. So the book is especially relevant. It's still relevant today. Yes, indeed. I find the story deeply inspiring, and I think there's something in the story in almost every part of Robinson's life that has relevance for today and today's racism.
As I said, I'm jumping around on you, Mike, but, you know, something you just mentioned, and that was significant that near the end of his life, Jackie Robinson stood with Black Panthers who were armed because Jackie Robinson preached nonviolence. He was a friend of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., had a public spat with Malcolm X, thought that there were a lot of young African-Americans that, and especially young African-Americans that were prone to violence or, you know, were just not, did not support nonviolence like Dr. King. So that was a big move for him to stand with the Black Panthers, wasn't it?
Oh, my goodness. I think it was huge. But at the same time, Robinson was not naturally nonviolent. He didn't have a peaceful personality. And this came to the fore, especially when just after the March on Washington, four little girls at 16th Street Baptist Church are murdered in a horrible bombing of the church. And Robinson says at this point that had he been the father of one of those girls, there's no way that he would have been peaceful like Dr. King, he would have probably broken some heads. And Robinson felt that way many times when he was working in the civil rights movement. He almost got into a fight in the 1964 political convention that nominated Barry Goldwater. Robinson was really fiery, and he did believe in the right to self-defense. I should add that as well. So his stance with the Black Panthers is surprising, you're right, because he did preach nonviolence as the right method for civil rights movement. But Robinson is a very complicated man. He's very complex, and this issue reveals that.
Yeah, I think the book really points that out, that he is a complicated man. Question here from Charlie in Millersville. He says, I know several musicians and actors experienced a similar phenomenon to Jackie Robinson regarding the need to play a stereotype to be accepted by whites at that time. Do you think this is still a significant issue today?
Yeah, I think it's less significant now, but I do think it still has relevance. I believe that sometimes Black Americans feel the need to speak in different ways to different audiences. And we've just seen this in a news story of last week. And I won't go into the details, but there are different platforms that Black Americans feel the need to reach. And sometimes that requires using one voice and then using another voice on another platform. It's unfortunate. But sometimes I believe that Black entertainers and Black superstars feel the need to switch voices sometimes. And the burden is on white America. It's on folks like me to make sure that Black Americans feel comfortable enough to use their own voice wherever they are.
The book is 42 Today, Jackie Robinson and His Legacy. Michael Long edited the book. It's a series of essays. Very good read. Again, just not a sports story, but one about America and civil rights. Mike Long, thank you very much for being with us today.
Scott, great to be with you. Spring training's just around the corner. Play ball.
That's right. A week from Sunday, first games. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Gas prices are rising. In Pennsylvania, the average price for a gallon of regular unleaded is $2.87. That's up 19 cents from last month, 21 cents from this time last year, just 8 cents. It's 8 cents from just last week. What's driving the price increases, and what will prices do in the coming weeks? Joining us now is Patrick DeHaan, head of Petroleum Analysis with GasBuddy.com. Mr. DeHaan, welcome to the program. If you have a question or a comment about gas prices, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so the big question, the basic question, Patrick DeHaan, why are gas prices rising?
Well, they continue to rise, but the next chapter, the next couple of weeks ahead of us is going to be driven by more so the cold weather in the South. The last 3 months or so, it's been predominantly the price of crude oil and recovery from the COVID pandemic, but that's going to be overtaken here in the next few days, starting in the next few days, lasting a week or two, as the cold weather in the South, specifically Texas, has shut down 20% of the nation's refining capacity and immediately having an impact on the amount of gasoline supplied.
So is it difficult to put a price increase on the shutdown of those refineries?
Well, you know, from what we're seeing, and it's kind of a moving target depending on what the news may be, how quickly these refineries can get back online. But I think so far, the total impact is going to be somewhere in the ballpark of 10 to 20 cents. Now, we've already seen the national average tick up about 4 cents of that already. So you could almost say, OK, do the math. 6 to 16 cents is still likely coming down the pipeline over the next week or two.
I want to go back before the cold weather, though, in the South. Prices had already started to rise beforehand. What was driving those price increases?
Those and by the way, those factors that drove that are still at work in the backdrop of this. So keep that in mind. But really, why we are here is because of a rebound in recovery. The vaccine really started to boost optimism back in mid and late November. We started to see Americans take to the road in a little bit higher frequency towards the holidays. That boosted demand. And now here we are, and by all metrics, COVID cases continue to go down. There are signs that the economy is further mending, increasing demand, not only in the US, but globally as well. And keep in mind, as a result of the deep wounds from the onset of the pandemic, oil producers had slashed output. That's now working against us as demand has recovered. Supply has not recovered in the same way. So that's really what it would take for oil prices to be put back into check, if you will.
So when I saw that social media post that someone on my Facebook page was talking about the rise in gas prices, and someone answered, blame Joe Biden and Governor Tom Wolf here in Pennsylvania for those price increases. That's not the case.
Oftentimes, politicians are the first finger we point, but that is not the case. President Biden, you know, he's obviously had some policy shifts already. The Keystone Pipeline permits have been revoked, and then drilling on federal land will be ceased in terms of new permits or new leases on federal land. But you talk about those impacts. They are not something that has immediate effect. Those are policies which will shape the future of prices years from now. But you look at it, and the explanation is this. Pipelines are not even at 100% capacity as it stands, simply because the reduction in demand from COVID. We've seen some recovery, but we're not at 100%. So killing a pipeline that was never online when capacity is not needed is not a material effect. Neither is oil companies ceasing drilling on new land when oil companies really aren't looking to start drilling yet. They had some significant battle wounds from 2020. Oil companies losing a collective close to $50 to $100 billion. No oil companies really looking to drill. So that's not a factor today. It will be in the years ahead, both of those. Pipeline capacity could be an issue in the years ahead, and drilling on federal land could be, but it's certainly not anywhere in the short term.
You mentioned several things before the pandemic, or excuse me, before the cold weather of last week, and that was supply and demand. Also, you know, that people are maybe starting to get out, and as the weather gets warmer, maybe they will be getting out more, and the price of crude oil being higher. How much does, and you know, I don't want to get it too much in the weeds, but I'm wondering, do speculators on Wall Street that buy and sell commodities, does that have anything to do with this?
Well, sure. You know, speculators, traders could be anyone. They could be, you know, 401k portfolio managers trying to manage your money and oil companies. And you know, speculation happens up and down. We speculate what the weather will be 5 days from now and plan on accordingly. So that's a natural part of trading. It doesn't necessarily drive prices incorrectly one way or another, but traders use news that is coming out in the market today to try and anticipate what's going to happen in a week or two from now and use that to their advantage. Sometimes they do it wrong, sometimes they do it right, but that is certainly just an inherent nature of trading. I don't think, you know, we've all pointed at them and said, oh, it's awful. But some of the times those speculative interests, you know, align with oil companies, and sometimes they don't.
It looks like, from what you've been describing, that the average price of a gallon of unleaded regular will go above the $3 a gallon mark here in the coming weeks. Much further than that, is it too early to tell?
Well, even that $3, you know, that is something that was a possibility. It is certainly not a guarantee at all. But it remains a possibility. The national average sits at $2.60 a gallon. If we continue to see broad recovery in demand without a notable uptick in production, then that would put $3 in contention for, say, April or May. However, earlier this week, Saudi Arabia had indicated it is prepared to raise production starting in April. That would act as a bucket of cold water on the rally in the price of oil and would probably remove $3 for national average off the table. But so far, the seeds are there that it still remains a possibility And depending on recovery in the pandemic, we could or could not get there. I think the only thing in watching markets as long as I have is that almost nothing is impossible. Improbable, perhaps, and I think I'd qualify the $3 as improbable, but it remains on the table.
Yeah, one thing I should remember is we're 287 in Pennsylvania, it's 260 nationally. Patrick DeHaan, head of petroleum analysis with GasBuddy.com, where you can find prices, high and low prices. Thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great weekend.